the sun in my right hand, put the moon in my left hand. Yeah? I can't stop. Need I say anymore?
Right. Now, this is the point. Mm. We have these examples. All of us, those who claim to be Muslims, know these stories.
We do?
We've read the Quran. We've read the Rawayat, whether it's Shia or Sunni.
Yes, these are...
Okay? Yeah. We've read them all.
Yeah.
Do we really believe them?
Well,
this is the question. Do we really act on it in our own lives? When the rubber hits the road? When the going gets tough?
When the going gets tough?
You know, yeah. I'm not going to use other expressions.
Please don't,
right?
Don't. Because right? Other images start coming to mind.
So the point is that
yeah,
when Imam is talking about this, way back then, okay, he's giving us a principle. He's giving us this the highway. He's giving us...
The road. Showing us the road.
A basic fundamental thing, which is, you know, it's better to be self-reliant and to, you know, have to work a little harder and to maybe have less of the things that you really think are really neat and cool.
Unnecessary, yeah.
And, you know, I really want that iPad, you know. Okay, well, maybe you won't get the latest model.
Sure.
Okay, but by the way, can I just say that anything you want in this world, you can find in Iran. Okay, just giving this as a news.
Yeah, as a news.
Okay,
yes,
sanctions has no effect.
I've seen that in Tehran.
Right?
I've seen that in Tehran.
Anything that's produced anywhere
in
the world,
you will find it in Tehran.
You know, 2 days later, it's in Tehran.
In 2 days.
At a reduced price.
Yes.
Yes. At a reduced price of what it's sold in the actual market.
Yeah, of course it is. It's cheaper.
And you understand, right?
I understand it because I've seen that. I've physically seen
it. So, you know, this is not something that's really...
No, you're not making that up.
Right. No. So... I don't know what it is that people are so crazy about. I think it goes back to one thing, which we've talked about many times before, which is that the main way in which Western powers have tried to dominate the Islamic world is through nurturing their own elites in Muslim worlds.
Exactly.
And how do they do that? They do that by making them the representatives of their business affairs in the home country, so that they can get percentages and that they can get the money from selling the Western goods in those countries. And this is how they run the affairs of things, and it's no different in Iran today as it was 40 years ago.
Well, on that note, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, thank you for that, but we need to review our path on Sirat al-Mustaqim, honestly.
Especially if you say that you follow Imam Khomeini.
Thank you very much indeed for that, sir. And I just say to our listeners, I hope you benefited from the program. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Hello, welcome to The Light. A family therapist in the U.S. state of California has come up with a brilliant idea to calm her angry clients, and that's a rage room. Yashika offers stressed people a smash session. The participants are allowed to destroy different items with a hammer, golf club, or baseball bat. They are required to wear protective gloves and face shields. During the session, the therapist also tries to teach the participants different ways to manage their stress in a healthy way.
So it's actually the first rage room to incorporate a therapeutic aspect. So when people come in, they're not just coming in to break stuff. They're really coming in to get the tools and techniques they need to manage stress and health in a healthy manner and a healthy way.
Yashika hopes the smash therapy will be largely accepted as a productive way to release tension. The idea was originally a simple stress reliever for everyday problems, but it was warmly received after everything started shutting down due to the pandemic. An Australian conservation group says it will build the world's first ever platypus refuge facility.
We're also going to build a platypus refuge, one of its kinds around the world. This refuge will be able to take up to 65 platypuses in a time of crisis. Right now there is so much to learn about the platypus, and we know so little. These facilities will be critical in building our knowledge so that we don't let this iconic creature slip off the earth.
Platypuses are among Australia's most unique and elusive animals. They're normally found across the country's eastern seaboard. The strange-looking creatures are the only remaining representatives of their family. They spend most of their lifetime underwater and alone. Australian authorities say the planned refuge facility can give them more information about the animals' preferred environment and breeding. Many habits of the platypuses have remained a mystery to researchers. Hungry for music? You can now order a concert instead of a pizza if you live in the German city of Frankfurt. Members of Frankfurt's Philharmonic Orchestra have decided to help music lovers now that concert halls are closed due to the pandemic. They offer short personal concerts at people's staircases for free. Instead, Frankfurt residents can donate money to the musicians, who say the main goal is to revive the creative industry.
We play miniature concerts in people's homes of about 10 minutes, and we deliver along a route in our neighborhood so that people can enjoy some live music. For us, it's just beautiful being able to play for people again. What's great and absurd about this concept at the same time is that we play in order to keep a distance, yet we are so much closer than in a conventional concert hall, and that makes it so wonderful for us.
Those who ordered the concerts have called their experience delightful. They say the music delivery service has filled the void of the closure of theaters and music halls. The personal concerts can be booked online, performers observe health protocols and social distancing too. A rare black rhino calf becomes an internet celebrity as a video of her first wobbly steps has gone viral. The cute baby was born last week at Adubo Zoo in New South Wales, Australia. The newborn, yet to be named, has three siblings. Her mother is 18 years old and her father passed away a few months ago. Zookeepers watched the calf and her mother through cameras in order to create a proper atmosphere for them to make bond. The species is critically endangered because of poaching and habitat loss. Sophisticated scanning technology is revealing new secrets about Littlefoot. That's a well-preserved fossil of an early human forerunner dating back to nearly 3.7 million years ago.
Now, the importance of it is not only that it is the only complete skull of an Australopithecus from anywhere, but it is the only one with a complete skeleton as well. Furthermore, it is the oldest Australopithecus in southern Africa, dating to 3.67 million years ago. So it tells us a lot about our early ancestry. Now, we're not saying that Littlefoot represents a direct ancestor to modern humans, but certainly a relative, certainly a very close relative of our ancestors.
The fossil was found in South Africa in the 1990s. It's now being studied at a particle accelerator facility in Oxfordshire, Britain. The facility allows scientists to produce X-ray images of the fossil with extreme detail. They say the result has been fascinating.
The bone microstructure looks amazing because we can really see the different tissues, the proportions, the thickness, and also the size of the different canals. So all of this make Littlefoot more like a living person.
So far, scientists have found that Littlefoot stood on her feet. They know she had gorilla-like features such as powerful hands, which enable her to climb trees. But she also had different traits compared to the human species believed to have first appeared 300,000 years ago. A Nigerian artist has become famous for his skills in creating art from coconut shells. Nathaniel Hodonu uses the shells to make stunning artworks in different forms, including portraits and sculptures, as well as home accessories. He collects shells from local oil factories, which throw them away as waste. He began his work in 2006 after his art teacher gave him two coconuts as a present. Hodonu now teaches art lovers creative ways to transform waste coconut shells into beautiful handicraft.
Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into boutique hotels. The beige-coloured homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple. And the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Misfat al-Ibrahim attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We, as a company, decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited the area because of the heritage hotels and environmental components in the ancient village. These inns have attracted many tourists to the area despite the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost everyone has seen snowmen, but how many people have encountered a snow snake in their lifetime? A family in the US has awed their neighborhood with a fascinating ice sculpture of a serpent. The household in Colorado spent 10 hours making the impressive artwork in their front yard. They first created the shape of the animal and then sprayed paint on it to bring it to life. The sculpture measures 23 meters in length. It has attracted many neighbors and passers-by who occasionally take pictures with it. This is not the first time the family made headlines with their ice work. In 2019, they caught people's eyes with an ice sculpture of a tiger. A giant ice disc with an even greater message. Here, people in Finland have carved a humongous carousel in Lake Lapajärvi to raise awareness about global warming. An inventor and a team of helpers spent days in sub-zero temperatures to create what they say is the world's largest ice carousel. The rotating machine is over 300 meters wide and is spun by motorboats. The makers also carved another smaller disc in the ice next to it. The two carousels were commissioned by local authorities who want to bring attention to climate change and shortening winters in Finland. An iceberg the size of Greater London breaks off in Antarctica years after the first cracks appeared. The iceberg detached from the Brunt ice shelf near a British research station and is expected to either move away or run aground not far from the ice shelf. Scientists were expecting the calving of the iceberg to happen after monitoring the area with GPS instruments and satellite imagery on a daily basis. They discovered the first cracks almost 10 years ago, but they are skeptical about the role of climate change in this case.
A unique remnant of bygone days. Archaeologists have found a rare ancient Roman ceremonial carriage outside Pompeii. The carriage was unearthed near the stables of a village just outside the very city. It has four wheels and is made of iron, bronze, and tin. The vehicle is the first of its kind discovered in the area. Italy's culture minister has called it a unique find without any precedent in the country. Pompeii was buried under ash and a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. So far, about two-thirds of the ancient city has been uncovered, I should say. The lights, merriment, and traditional food. That's what China's Lantern Festival has brought to millions of people across the country.
Loneliness can hit anyone at any time, but it becomes severe during the pandemic-like scenario the world is going through. But some Japanese are enjoying the companionship of robots to overcome loneliness as they are unable to meet their loved ones during the coronavirus. The cute singing snowman is called Charlie. He is one among a large number of new generation clever robots being produced in Japan. Manufacturers are making a wide variety of affordable androids as well as robotic pets, and they say their sales are booming. They also say their products have found favor with customers of all ages, not just kids. Studies have shown that therapeutic pets can bring comfort to dementia patients. That's a wrap-up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
MIT Assistant Professor Kevin Yufeng Chen says, if we look at most drones today, they're usually quite big, adding, most of their applications involve flying outdoors. The question is, can you create insect-scale robots that can move around in very complex, cluttered spaces? We're prepared for you an article written by Daniel Ackerman, a researcher at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. The piece is titled, Insect-Inspired Flying Robots, Researchers Introduce a New Generation of Tiny Agile Drones. The article has been taken from the SciTechDaily.com website. Please stay with us to hear more of Daniel Ackerman's article. The technology could boost aerial robots' repertoire, allowing them to operate in cramped spaces and withstand collisions. If you ever swatted a mosquito away from your face only to have it return again and again and again, you know that insects can be remarkably acrobatic and resilient in flight. Those traits help them navigate the aerial world with all of its wind, gusts, obstacles, general uncertainty. Such traits are also hard to build into flying robots, but MIT Assistant Professor Kevin Yufeng Chen has built a system that approaches insects' agility. Chen, a member of the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science and a research laboratory of electronics, has developed insect-sized drones with unprecedented dexterity and resilience. The aerial robots are powered by a new class of soft actuator, which allows them to withstand the physical travails of real-world flight. Chen hopes the robots could one day aid humans by pollinating crops or performing machinery inspections in cramped spaces. Professor Chen's work appears this month in the journal IEEE Transactions on Robotics. His co-authors include MIT PhD student Zhijian Ren, Harvard University PhD student Si Zhu, and City University of Hong Kong roboticist Pakpong Chiraratananun. Typically, drones require wide-open spaces because they're neither nimble enough to navigate confined spaces nor robust enough to withstand collisions in a crowd. Professor Chen says, if we look at most drones today, they're usually quite big, adding, most of their applications involve flying outdoors. The question is, can you create insect-scale robots that can move around in very complex, cluttered spaces? According to Chen, the challenge of building small aerial robots is immense. Pint-sized drones require a fundamentally different construction from larger ones. Large drones are usually powered by motors, but motors lose efficiency as you shrink them. So, Professor Chen says, for insect-like robots, you need to look for alternatives. The principal alternative until now has been employing a small rigid actuator built from piezoelectric ceramic materials. While piezoelectric ceramics allowed the first generation of tiny robots to take flight, they're quite fragile, and that's a problem when you're building a robot to mimic an insect. Foraging bumblebees endure a collision about once every second. Professor Chen designed a more resilient tiny drone using soft actuators instead of hard, fragile ones. The soft actuators are made of thin rubber cylinders coated in carbon nanotubes. When voltage is applied to the carbon nanotubes, they produce an electrostatic force that squeezes and elongates the rubber cylinder. Repeated elongation and contraction causes the drone's wings to beat fast. MIT professor Kevin Yufeng Chen's actuators can flap nearly 500 times per second, giving the drone insect-like resilience. Chen says you can hit it when it's flying and it can recover, adding, it can also do aggressive maneuvers like somersaults in the air, and it weighs in at just 0.6 grams, approximately the mass of a large bumblebee. The drone looks a bit like a tiny cassette tape with wings, though Chen is working on a new prototype shaped like a dragonfly. Farrell Helbling, an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at Cornell University, who was not involved in the research, says, achieving flight with a centimeter-scale robot is always an impressive feat, adding, because of the soft actuator's inherent compliance, the robot can safely run into obstacles without greatly inhibiting flight. This feature is well suited for flight in cluttered, dynamic environments and could be very useful for any number of real-world applications. Farrell Helbling added, a key step towards those applications will be untethering the robots from a wired power source, which is currently required by the actuator's high operating voltage. Helbling notes, I'm excited to see how the authors will reduce operating voltage so that they may one day be able to achieve untethered flight in real-world environments. Building insect-like robots can provide a window into the biology and physics of insect flight, a long-standing avenue of inquiry for researchers. Professor Chen's work addresses these questions through a kind of reverse engineering. He says, if you want to learn how insects fly, it is very instructive to build a scale robot model, adding, you can perturb a few things and see how it affects the kinematics or how the fluid forces change. That will help you understand how those things fly. But Professor Chen aims to do more than add to entomology textbooks. His drones can be useful in industry and agriculture. Professor Chen says his mini aerialists could navigate complex machinery to ensure safety and functionality, adding, think about the inspection of a turbine engine. You'd want a drone to move around an enclosed space with a small camera to check for cracks on the turbine plates. Other potential applications include artificial pollination of crops or completing search and rescue missions following a disaster. Professor Chen says, all those things can be very challenging for existing large-scale robots. Sometimes, bigger isn't better.
We get people.
U.S. Media Monopoly.
The role that the media and the press play in the United States is crucial for both people high up in power and for those on the streets. It's no surprise that spreading disinformation has real-world consequences, in some cases, dangerous ones. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javan Mardi, and in this episode, we will ask, how much of the truth does the mass media reflect as the human quest for truth continues? We will try to find out what potential dangers could be arising from the monopoly on mainstream media in the United States. And then, what about the viewers facing a barrage of fake news and partisan media channels? Is there any trust left? Thank you for staying with us.
It amazes me when I read the Wall Street Journal, which is always so negative. It amazes me when I read the New York Times is not even, I barely read it. You know, we don't distribute it in the White House anymore, and the same thing with the Washington Post. They are siding with China. They are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. They're siding with many others. China's the least of it. It is fake news. It's more than fake news. It's corrupt news.
Media outlets work based on profit, and they have never been more consolidated than today. They tend to give their consumers what they want to hear and act in the interests of the umbrella corporations controlling them. On the other hand, U.S.-owned social media such as Twitter and Facebook are amplifying disinformation and cracking down on freedom of speech.
What they choose to fact-check and what they choose to ignore or even promote is nothing more than a political activism group or political activism, and it's inappropriate.
But I think one of the most terrifying parts of it involves a suggestion that the government should be setting ground rules for what speech is or is not allowed on a platform.
Today, concentration of media ownership by only a few companies or individuals has a big say in the United States' political spectrum. Former President Donald Trump was banned from Twitter after he refused to accept the election result. Yet for years, Trump had been using the platform to issue threats to other nations and politicians. We're now joined by Mr. Tim Kirby. Mr. Kirby, please tell us about the disinformation being projected today and how it's changed through time, and what makes it unique and specifically dangerous.
This is nothing new, and disinformation has existed throughout all time, and even during the more golden age of the media that people sort of prop up, like the 50s and 60s and 70s, this height of journalistic integrity, even then it really existed as well. So I don't think that the disinformation existing is particularly different now. The difference is that with the rise of the internet and the accessibility of the internet, the speed and the ability to be disinformed from various different sources has sort of changed the nature of the game. There's more competition, and the speed is much faster.
Trump's lack of access to Twitter has indeed shifted the dynamics of the so-called MAGA movement under President Biden. The particular platform that has blocked certain figures will lose their supporters not just on the platform, but also in the stocks. Twitter shares closed down more than 6% lower on the first trading day after the Trump ban.
We've seen abuse, we've seen harassment, we've seen people leave our platform because of it, we've seen voices being silenced because of what's happening on the service, and that is number one. Like, we can't build a platform of speech, a platform of conversation, and a service that will remain relevant to people if people don't feel safe to speak up in the first place. So for all those who believe in free expression and all those who believe in free speech, it's critical that we're not utilizing technologies like Twitter to shut down voices.
Liberal media's tough stance on the Capitol siege Trumpists also has long-term ramifications that will widen the gap in America. It also unashamedly panders to the Democrats. That is how the media is playing its part in the American divide.
It's no surprise to see distrust in media, as well as rising partisanship, extremism, and even domestic terrorism. But how did we get here? Let's see what Kristen Harris thinks. Mr. Harris, your take.
I think that the major issue with disinformation is it pushes people to go look in different areas for their news. For example, you have a larger amount of people than ever that are getting their news from forums, like what we saw with the QAnon thing, where they no longer trust the mainstream media narrative due to all the disinformation that to them is easily debunked because they can go search on the internet for alternative facts or different informations or downloads that may support their point of view.
Take what the conservatives call cancel culture and how it's raging today on social media. Many right-wing figures are being canceled on social media and the conservative voice is being silenced at a time when the election is being disputed and recognition of the new president is under question.
So what happened with your Twitter account and the company page?
Well, first, mine was taken down because we have all the election fraud with these Dominion machines. We have 100% proof. And then when they took it down about 3 weeks ago, I put it back up. My personal,
Mike, thank you very much. You're talking about machines that we at Newsmax have not been able to verify any of those kinds of allegations. We just want to let people know that there's nothing substantive that we've seen. And let me read you something there. While there were some clear evidence of some cases of vote fraud and election irregularities, the election results in every state were certified.
As liberals retake power in the year 2021, the left-leaning media looks more aggressive than ever in the wake of the Trump era. The liberal agenda and how it is using mass media to promote it is a lengthy one. But forced equity, diversity, as well as political correctness are reshaping the American society in a fashion that could ultimately spin out of control. So what are the costs of a biased media today?
Adrenaline junkies and people of different right-wing groups were involved, and one of those was QAnon people. And the reason why people turn to things like QAnon, it's because the media has become so biased to one point of view to the point where a whole half of the United States doesn't deem them credible. And even the people on the left question what the mainstream media narrative is. So what it does is it forces people to get their news from forums where strange people post bizarre beliefs, and when you ban all the independent media, essentially under the guise of Russian collusion, there's no gatekeeper there.
The pace of media takeovers by large national and multinational corporations has been increasing since mid-20th century. Currently, six giant conglomerates control 90% of what media consumers read, watch, and listen to. General Electric, Viacom, Time Warner, CBS, News Corp, and Disney control a majority of American-owned media.
Together, these six empires, federations, alliances own about 90% of all media in the United States. In 1983, or the old Republic era, there were 50 companies owning that same share of media. So why is this important? Should you be worried? Well, it's not exactly a black and white issue.
Enormous media conglomerates have expanded their influence, leading to a shortage of meaningful content and alternative viewpoints. Trust in the news media is being eroded, and some communities are growing in their own alternate reality, yielded by the one-sided media they consume. How do media treat those trying to disrupt its agenda?
I think the idea of this pro-Trump revolution was terrifying enough that they've now put the stakes down. Because even before this, they started to ban conservatives who are more, more eccentric conservatives, more vibrant conservatives, like Alex Jones and a few others. But now they've just blanket attack any conservative who is conservative or right-wing enough to not accept their agenda.
Trump's supporters' attack on the Capitol is one contemporary example of how media falsehood could create cults. The former president's fans refused to accept the reality that Trump's allegations of election fraud had been left out of court.
They then began fantasizing about how their leader had a hidden trick up his sleeve not to allow Biden to enter office as the president.
Hundreds of thousands of people here, and I just want them to be recognized by the fake news media. Turn your cameras, please, and show what's really happening out here, because these people are not going to take it any longer. They're not going to take it any longer. All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
So in reality, they rushed at the request of the president to supposedly save their democracy and their votes. The other side of the coin is the thirst for truth by the youth, women, people of color, and immigrants, which is yet to be quenched. But what role did US media play in the deadly breach of the Capitol by Trump supporters, and what are the aftermath?
That's an important thing, because remember, the media always has the option to just ignore something. If it didn't happen on TV, it didn't happen, is the old expression. I would say that maybe now if it didn't happen on YouTube, it didn't happen. We could update that for the 21st century. But they did choose to show it. But they definitely made it clear that these people are bad. They are all Nazis, even the black people who were part of it, and so on. They put a very clear sort of framing on it, and that somehow it is definitely Trump being at fault.
The narrative is controlled by virtue of the ownership of giant media corporations. Many media property owners tend to follow the approach adopted by elected officials who know the truth, but instead choose to propagate lies. Controlled by one czar, the American public would have a good reason to fear for its democracy and remain skeptic about what they read on social media outlets.
Multiple, well-documented significant harms. And we actually have to confront these harms head-on when trying to make decisions about whether or not we embrace this technology and let it into our lives. So one of these harms that we know this technology brings has to do with your professional success. So I just argued before that the ability to focus intensely to produce things that are rare and valuable, to hone skills that the marketplace values, that this is what's going to matter in our economy. But right before that, I argued that social media tools are designed to be addictive.
Stereotype of an American surfing through TV channels somehow captures the struggle for finding out truth. But those high up want to stay in power, prepared to do whatever it takes to manipulate the discourse. How successful have czars controlling U.S. media been in manipulating the narrative?
Well, pretty effective. It's been effective enough to get the United States involved in a lot of wars. The United States has entered World War I, Vietnam, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars over very dubious claims. I mean, we never found those weapons of mass destruction, did we? So in a lot of ways, the narrative is created by the media. And in fact, there's really no other narrative outside of theirs. They control that, they create it, and for better or worse, we receive it. And unfortunately, it would look like as time goes on, it gets worse and worse.
There is no real access to truly diverse and competing sources of news, literature, entertainment, and popular culture. Concentrated power over public information has created a niche for the alternatives. Some are taking advantage of the gap in the market by promoting conspiracy theories. Trump was a master of employing conspiracy theories and using them to his advantage.
You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going in his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. The FBI conducted a year-long investigation into my emails. They concluded there was no case. He said the FBI was rigged. He lost the Iowa caucus. He lost the Wisconsin primary. He said the Republican primary was rigged against him. Then Trump University gets sued for fraud and racketeering. He claims the court system and the federal judge is rigged against him. There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged.
What is the liberal agenda, and how is it using mass media to promote it? That's what Danny's going to talk about today. Hello, Danny. What do you have for us?
Thank you, Milad. This week, I am talking diversity and answering the questions, does diversity in the United States lead to justice? Does it lead to peace? And how does diversity maintain the status quo amid unprecedented crisis and societal decay? The answer is no. Diversity does not lead to justice, and it doesn't lead to peace. The corporate media has praised Joe Biden for his diverse cabinet, and the Los Angeles Times has given the front page to Kamala Harris, his vice president, who is a black woman, and has praised Joe Biden for nominating Lloyd Austin as the Secretary of Defense. Yet Lloyd Austin was a board member of Raytheon, one of the major weapons manufacturers in the world, which produces weapons of mass destruction deployed in black and brown nations around the world to destroy them. Kamala Harris is an agent of the police state, of the mass incarceration state, as a DA and as a prosecutor and as a senator. She has mocked activists for advocating for the defunding of prisons and the funding of public education. She has also been responsible for massive arrests of black Americans, mainly for minor drug possession. These are not the kind of leaders that diversity should be promoting. So why does the corporate media promote this kind of diversity? Because, in fact, a more diverse empire is a more effective empire. The United States is able to wage wars around the world, institute devastating economic inequality, and maintain a racist power structure, all the while claiming that it, in fact, has gotten closer to being less racist because of diversity. This is what leads to developments like Donald Trump and the extreme right. And we need to understand how diversity does not mean justice and peace if we are going to have a more progressive and more peaceful future in the United States and abroad.
In the late Obama era, Trump took the chance to put his ideas into test. He told America's story in a rather novel way compared to the US media, and many gravitated to him. After 4 years in office, the president fabricated tens of thousands of lies and baseless allegations, but his supporters still considered him the only honest man in the room. So what were the dynamics of the communication between Trump and his supporters?
Media is the reason why Donald Trump used Twitter, because he used it as a way to talk directly to the American people. Not that I agree with the things he said, but it was for the first time in history that we've seen a president be able to communicate directly with the people, and they did this through Twitter. Now, making threats on Twitter, do I think that's a presidential thing to do? Absolutely not. I think that maybe some of it was for show. Some of it was so that the message may not be perverted, but I think a phone call and a conversation would have been a much better option.
Media is at the center of the American power play. Having a real choice of politics and ideas has become a more scarce phenomenon, as many people repeat the talking points fed to them by media, and that is their political view. The media knows that and is somehow making a benefit by pumping that certain attitude towards life and politics.
It's important to believe in, you know, to have respect for everyone's religion.
Do you respect Christianity?
I do.
Judaism?
Yes.
Islam?
No.
Can a woman be president?
The presidency is a man's job.
I have women are qualified to be president.
No. A female has more hormones. She could start a war in 10 seconds.
The people tend to follow news outlets they agree with. The outlets are making money through their supporters, so they're more adamant in highlighting what their viewers want. They could help one another get increasingly ignorant.
The media has the ability to turn the light switch on and off using their data. And for some people, it works very well as far as controlling information and allowing people to download certain viewpoints and conditioning them that certain things are acceptable. There's a large and growing amount of cognitive dissonance amongst Americans due to them watching media.
In a society where inaccuracy and biases abound, seeking truth remains a serious challenge. Media property owners must be held accountable, along with elected officials, for lying to the nation and opting for power over truth. Yet in reality, both the media and officials mostly choose to propagate lies serving their own interests.
You use words like garbage and lies and smear to describe the recent wave of stories about your past. Are you saying that organizations like Politico and CNN and the Wall Street Journal are deliberately trying to damage you?
Yes.
Why?
To put it simply, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Why?
Because, you know, when you deliberately lie and you put that out as a story, or you do shabby investigation and you say, we've investigated and we can't find anything. I mean, is that an acceptable standard? I mean, you're in the media. Is that acceptable?
Generally, journalists have to nail down a story before they publish it or broadcast it.
Right. So I don't have any problem with people looking at my past. I don't have any problem whatsoever with being vetted. But when people are outright dishonest, that's worrisome to me.
Guest tonight is Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist and author of the new book, Political Suicide, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Ted, thank you for joining us. Let's get to it. We want to know basically to what extent the American public has lost faith in what is sometimes referred to as the mainstream media.
There's a allegory relating to people's congressmen. Congress for a long time in the United States has had an approval rating hovering around 10, 11, 12%. And yet incumbent congressmen keep getting reelected. So why? It's because people don't like Congress in general, but they like their own congressmen, or at least they're willing to tolerate them. Same thing I think is true about distrust of corporate media. In general, people have an understanding that systemically they don't trust what comes out of corporate media. That it's a lot of it's propaganda, that the corporate ownership has a huge influence. But in terms of the outlets that they like or that they tolerate, or perhaps more accurately, that they dislike the least, for example, if you're a conservative, that might be Fox. If you're a liberal, that might be MSNBC. They have more of a love-hate relationship with those outlets. And even though they might say that they don't trust the whole system, the fact is they do listen to and watch to these and read these outlets, and it ends up being the source of much of what they believe. So it's, if there was really widespread distrust of all corporate media outlets in the U.S., they wouldn't really have substantial influence. But they clearly do. They shape the narrative in a very real way, so the things that are not true become true, and they become widely accepted. So, for example, Russiagate scandal, or that are, you know, didn't happen, but, you know, most Americans think it did, especially depending on which outlet you watch. So it's kind of like the Congress thing. People don't trust the whole thing overall, but whether they admit it to themselves, much less to pollsters, or not, there are outlets that they are listening to, watching, and reading, and they are trusting them, even though maybe they shouldn't.
Interesting stuff, as always. We want to thank you so much, Ted, for joining us tonight. We want to thank audiences at home for tuning in. For Press TV's We the People, I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
Whether it's about the election, public health, or climate change, divide rages on in U.S. media today. This is while the elite in control of news and entertainment keep targeting the average person consuming immense amounts of information, news, and entertainment every day, a phenomenon that has made a large number of Americans addicted to the media. Thank you for watching the show. Please join us again next week when we'll come back with another episode of We the People.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent and the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the Worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. I wish to greet the dear people of Tabriz and Azerbaijan and to commemorate the history and unforgettable 29th of Behmen, which is unfortunately being held this way out of necessity via video conference. Every year, we used to meet with you up close at this Husseinia, and we used to be happy because of the presence of you dear people and because of the enthusiasm generated by your Azerbaijani and Tabrizi sentiments. Unfortunately, this year it is not possible to do so, and this is one of the various ups and downs in life. Every day passes in a different way. I hope that these obstacles will be eliminated soon, God willing. I congratulate all you dear ones, the people of Tabriz and Azerbaijan, and the masses of the people of Iran on the arrival of the month of Rajab, and I hope that everyone will benefit from the spiritual blessings of this month.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, there will be no public gatherings this month, and what was possible every year for the people, religious gatherings, spiritual prayers, and dhikr, it is not possible this year. But you should not forget about the prayers of Rajab at home, as they are very good prayers. This temporary cancellation of gatherings should not make us forget about the blessings of this month, and about praying and supplication before God. First of all, I will say a few things about the characteristics of Tabriz and Azerbaijan. Although I have discussed these matters at length, I believe that they should be repeated so that the minds of our dear youth, in particular the minds of dear youth from that area, will become more familiar with them. After that, I will raise a few points about the 29th of Behmen event, the very important historic event, and also a few points about the lesson that we should learn from it, so that by benefiting from this great lesson, we will be able to eliminate the shortcomings and that we have today. I will also briefly discuss the issue of the elections.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
And on day 36 of his term, U.S. President Joe Biden dropped his first ever bomb on Syria. It must have been such a proud moment for his so very diverse cabinet, especially for Kamala Harris, the first woman vice president of color to drop a bomb on a sovereign nation. Because why on earth not? Diplomacy is back, President Joe Biden declared at the Munich Security Conference last week. But so is bombing Syria, apparently. Biden has only been president a bit more than a month, but he has already ordered his first bombing campaign. Mind you, it took Trump 4 months to do the same. The target was a military checkpoint in eastern Syria used by the Syrian Arab Army and their allies, the Iraqi PMU, to secure the borders from Daesh attacks. But why use U.S. war jets and U.S.-made bombs to obliterate the actual Daesh terrorists when you can't eliminate the only force capable of defeating Daesh? Presumably, Biden wanted to signal to Iran, as the JCPOA diplomacy window was about to be opened, that it would pay a heavy price if it keeps up its support for the regional resistance. But by bombing Syria for this reason, Biden proved how failing to rejoin the nuclear agreement endangers U.S. interests in the region, while Iran's nuclear program continues to advance. What Biden did was not shifting to diplomacy in any way. Rather, he kept up the empire's risky warmongering rhetoric, making the U.S. and Iran glide closer to a military confrontation. While Biden campaigned on a commitment to return to his JCPOA, his attempt to play hardball with Iran and his airstrikes against Syria and his refusal to remove suffocating sanctions on Iran signaled a foreign policy intent on continuing U.S. imperialism in West Asia. The U.S. airstrikes also signaled the Biden administration's support for the Israeli regime, which had its own array of airstrikes along the Syria-Iraq border over the years. Biden, of course, is no stranger to the use of airstrikes. As vice president, he was complicit in the Obama administration's attempts to institute regime change all across the region, infamously bombing seven different countries at one time. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marla Osman. First military action since inauguration, Joe Biden launched a series of airstrikes against Syria, signaling a renewed imperialist offensive in the region. This serves as a reminder for the victims of U.S. imperialism abroad that there is no lesser evil when it comes to the U.S. It is simply back to normal for the U.S. as Biden and his Vice President Kamala Harris are only escalating the wars started by former President Barack Obama. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Sharmeen Narwani, political commentator and journalist. Thank you for being with us, Sharmeen. Now, Biden thought that he was giving the world